Well, to play devil's advocate here, I mean, I think the synchromystic community can be guilty of the same thing of, you know, every time we find a sink, it's like, is that not being surprised by the Jack in the Box? Oh my God, did you see in this movie this happens, you know? So ultimately, you know, it's like you continue to unpeel the onion of conspiracy around geopolitical events, or you can continue to peel the onion around, you know, cosmic coincidences in artwork and things like that. At some point, you have to stop being surprised by it. It doesn't mean you stop studying. Like, if anything, the fact, and I hope I don't sound like pompous, I want to be really careful how I say this, is like, I feel like having studied both, I went through a heavily conspiratorial phase, and then I went through a heavily, you know, synchronicity studying phase. I think there's something to be said for, okay, well, there are events that I believe this is evidence of control. There are things where I think this is evidence of synchronicity. And understanding, like, the reason to keep studying would be to say, how do these things emerge? Let's try and boil it down and see if we can have some discernment here. What is what event? And more often than not, I think it's a combination of both anyway. You know, to say, is it intentional? Is it synchronicity? Well, you know, a lot of these cases, it's an interplay of the two. But yeah, I think if you're using Sandy Hook as your evidence to wake people up to the New World Order, I think, you know, that's a pretty shitty example. And not to trivialize the event of children dying, but rather to say, you know, really, 5,000 people dying on 9/11, that didn't do it, that didn't convince you that there's evil bastards out there, you know.
World War II, or the Civil War, you know, right, hundreds of thousands of deaths, the Holocaust. I mean, if you're allowing your outrage and grief and fear to contaminate your synchromystic theories and what you're trying to discover, like, it's going to get weird. And it's difficult to, yeah, you can't point fingers and say bad synchromystic. You can't, you know, attempt to want to speak to someone that you disagree with and say, this is why you're wrong, you know. But there seems something very irresponsible to drop out of the conversation altogether. To watch somebody drive off a cliff.
That's interesting, because you just said you felt like you came to a point where you had to walk away. Are you saying, I'm not trying to paint you into a corner, but do you think that's, how do you reconcile those two things of like trying to walk away, and then if you feel like you're watching someone drive off a cliff?
I think what you have to do is to construct I think what you have to do is you have to construct art as the biggest umbrella term that you can. Something that attracts enough attention to where when the conversation starts to deconstruct your art, you have the keys to the castle. You have created the thing that has confused or generated so much discussion. That's why Kubrick is the master. 2001, what does it mean? You know, he sat back and digested how many different times could he dip into the bag and read about what exactly it was or what exactly he was trying to say? And knowing full well what it was that he had created, but still being smart enough to entertain to appreciate that he created the movie, he put what he wanted into the movie, but he also manifested all these things out of a usually dull and silent population. That he could make people so completely angry or people so completely inspired, that he, in a sense, created that as well. That's sort of where I think the goal is, and we've discussed that before, Alan. And I think, you know, David's artwork is, you know, a good representation of that. Is the moving into the practical arts, you know, like this is all the liberal arts. This is all the understanding, and it should inform the practical arts on some level, right? Like, I don't know, I'm rambling, I guess.
Are you gonna start telling us about the trivium, Bill?
It's about the trivium. It's the trivium and the quadrivium, and I'm starting a 10-week course. It's gonna be at $275.
I read a thing the other day, or I read part of the thing the other day, of this guy talking about his feeling that Jake Kotza, in particular, had stolen his ideas and was going on this rant about it. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
It was on your the Goro Adachi thing, right? From, like, years ago.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. It says, I hope I'm not about to stir up a fiery debate here for my own amusement, but what... Okay, so this is somebody else's point. Yeah, Goro Adachi or something.
Yeah, he's in the first sync book.
Yeah, he's an old school. I mean, he's the thing is, yeah, him and Jake had a work. All right, I didn't want to step into that conversation simply because it's a conversation I found myself stepping into unintentionally with the first sync book. They have a history together that I wasn't really familiar with, and by putting them both in the first sync book, I sort of opened a little bit of a can of worms there. But, well, something I was thinking about doing, I'm just going to say it. I'd like to move on simply because I want to talk to Goro first. I actually have a lot of respect for Goro's work, but, you know, he feels very strongly about what happened with Jake, and Jake's never done anything bad to me. I can't. You know, I don't want to take sides in someone's argument. But what I was thinking about doing actually was Goro does not do audio interviews. We've asked him, and I've actually spoken to him. He said he was asked to do Red Eyes and Coast to Coast and stuff like that, but he just can't do audio interviews for whatever reason. So something I was thinking about doing was perhaps doing an email back and forth formatting questions. Maybe we could do it 42 minute style or however we want to do it, and maybe have someone read that as Goro. So as long as it's his own words and stuff like that, but we can create a sort of audio interview where someone is reading his text, and if we would have to build this over a few week back and forth emails or something. Maybe we could do it that way and let Goro speak for himself as to what he thinks. We can, you know, we could ask him about that whole situation, let him voice his opinion on it. But I'm very hesitant to put words in anyone's mouth or take a side in that. And I've already stepped into this mess unintentionally more than once, and I don't want to do it again.
I didn't bring it up to even go there in that way or try and get into the nitty-gritty of what it is that he's saying. I feel that all what their particular situation is aside, I just that aspect of the fact that it's like this is a big issue, the idea of owning ideas, which I stand the argument to a certain extent. I think that there is something to be said for when you have an insight into something. I mean, in other fields, this is it's a huge part, but how do things. It's not just to discern what who gets credit, but what came from where in order to kind of, you know, but this is just like ideas are people have this argument that ideas are just floating around and that, you know, anyone could have figured this out, and so why does it matter where it came from? But then when somebody gets popularized to a certain degree and everyone's looking at that person, kind of makes a name for themselves through that, it gets really tricky. I mean, but what I wanted to say was just, you had mentioned, the artistic side of things, and like that has felt like, more the, like, at least lately, the more the avenue of what I've been more interested in is just expressing things in terms of an artistic statement. Even though, you know, I try to, you know, approach things in a, like, I can discuss these matters. I'm not like, you know, I don't explain my art or something. But I really like, I appreciate approaching these things as an art form, because it doesn't seem like, it seems like it allows more freedom in that way, to not have to concern myself as much with that. Because that's quite a fucking headache to look at. And why one would be tempted to. And so, I mean, and it's hard with this kind of information to just repeatedly say where you got. Like, to, I mean, it's nice to be able to try and give credit where credit is due, it can be a, I mean, if you're trying to, it's hard enough to just to tie these pieces together to try and present it in a way that people are able to receive, let alone along the whole way to be showing where you got every part, you know?
Well, right. We said earlier, I said iron. I said, iron, that's Mars, right? Like, I didn't say, and you know who came up with that idea, but that's not my idea. I didn't.
Yeah.
It's, we all know when there's a time to give credit, right? Like, let's say I went on a rant about Kubrick and the moon and how it could possibly be an admission of him filming, and I pass that on as my idea.
I would generally
say, you know, Jay Widener's work, I would preface that. I wouldn't just say, I've been doing a lot of work recently, and I've come up to the conclusion
that exactly.
We know that exactly. There's a difference there.
Exactly.
And there could be a very subtle distinction to where Kotz might say, hey, Goro, I don't really think your shit is on that level. I think it's pretty surface. And Goro could be saying, bullshit, the reason you're using it so much is because it's not surface. And I can see where those two could have beef in the middle of that. There is one element to, and I know we didn't want to get too deep into the exact argument that was there, and I think that argument was like 5 years ago or something, but Goro did say that he had talked to Jake, and Jake had said something, it's what you were saying, Al, you know, I don't feel like I have the time to reference everything that I'm discussing. And
yeah.
And I could see how someone could feel insulted when they're already in an amped up state.
Oh yeah. And that was basically what Goro wrote to me, as he said that he asked Jake very nicely, you know, if you're going to use my stuff, can you at least just say, you know, reference where you got that from? And, you know, you could put a link or something at the end. And if you look at Jake's old videos, he would say, thanks to blah, blah, blah. You know, I got this in, you know, whether it's a link or the name of a researcher or whatever. And then I think as Jake sort of developed his own thing and has started to say, okay, I've processed all these ideas and now this is my synergized philosophy that I've come from these things, maybe I don't need to credit them anymore. Because now is the, it's sort of like David's artwork, right? David, your artwork is a, and I'm just saying again, just as a devil's advocate here. So you're taking images that are other people's images, but what's yours is the synergy of those things. So everyone's starting with these Lego bricks, and then you're choosing to put them together in such a way that that's yours. You're the only one who put them together in that way. But do you give credit to that image, you know, third row over to the left? That's from this photographer from such and such. No.
The amount of trouble that would take would be fucking... I got literally thousands of images.
Right. So I think once... It's hard. What I'm saying is, exactly, once you're at a point where you've really... If you've ingested enough research and enough data that you think you're synergizing a million things and you've come up with, okay, this is what I think it all means, and now you've studied Masonic... you know, stuff and Rosicrucian stuff and synchromystic stuff and Goro stuff and this guy's stuff and, you know, Jay Widener's stuff and this guy's stuff. And now you say, okay, and this is kind of what I've come to based on all those things. But yes, I also think there is a point at which if you're going to say, and I think your Jay Widener example was perfect, at some point you have to say, this is really where I, you know, this is the guy who focuses on that. If I do a post that is sort of in the vein of someone else's stuff, sometimes I'll read a post of somebody's or be inspired by someone's work, and I'll sort of focus on that a little bit. But this guy has covered that already, and he's the one who initially inspired me. I think that's the – and my point to Goro was that I agree that I think in the age of the internet, a link is fucking free, and it's not that hard to do.
Yeah. I mean, with Kubrick, with the moon landing, Jay Widener definitely was not the first to present that idea. Though Jay Widener was the one who gave more evidence for that possibility than anybody I've seen. There was that mockumentary that went into it, which may have come out after, Jay Widener presented that. But it seems so, as soon as fucking Danny stands up in his fucking Apollo sweater, and then you start to see references being made in 2000, it just add two and two right there as a possibility. But then introducing the idea of front screen projection, or where, you know, and looking for that line in every shot. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure if Jay Widener was the first to present I don't think he was the first to present the lunar landings, the film of the lunar landing being fake. A lot of people have thought that, but he, as far as I know, was the first person I've seen made the connection between Kubrick being the at the forefront that kind of technique, and the timing of the lunar landings, and how that is actually a probable argument. Like, that's not an unreasonable assessment. I mean, he was the one who was doing that kind of work more than anybody, and doing it well. At the time when you'd have to be, doing that. So, I don't know.
Why the fuck isn't Jay here for this conversation? This is silly. David, you're doing a great job of explaining the man's work, but I'm a little annoyed that he's not here to present himself.
Yeah, and he hasn't even responded to an email today, so.
Who knows what's going on with him? Maybe, he's just... He's having a baby, I mean, maybe he's having a moon child. I don't know. I see someone fucking speeding on the freeway or something, someone's like, I try and remember. I don't know what their circumstances are.
Absolutely.
I don't want to make assumptions. And just because, once again, something happened twice, you don't know what's going on with somebody,
Yeah, I just, shit. You know what, though, David, in the internet age, with email, with, how everyone is connected to computer. Hell, he was on the computer yesterday Skyping to Vinnie Eastwood, and I sent him a confirmation email as requested yesterday.
Right.
So, what, he can't just see an email and go, oh, sorry, guys, not going to be there? But to have no response and to just miss something that you said you were going to be at, that's just... twice in a row, I don't wait for a third time with that kind of thing. I get the message and I back the fuck out.
That's basic.
I don't talk bad about the guy. He just chose not to treat me as professionally as I treated him. Maybe my show or our show doesn't hold the kind of weight for him that he feels he can just blow it off. That's fine. And I won't treat his work or him any differently. But I might be a little bit more inclined in the future to... not take the benefit of the doubt if I have issue with some of his research. I mean, that's just being honest,
Fair enough. Fair enough. All right.
I have to say I do feel similarly about you don't... Like, here's the thing. Like, someone can make a mistake and you could say, oh, shit, I forgot that I had this show scheduled. But especially if you burn someone the first time, you would then make a conscious effort to remember, oh man, I fucked up last time, let me make sure to mark my calendar and remember to do it. Like you said, he if he figured out how to get on Vinnie Eastwood's show last night, he could figure this out. Not trying to be a dick, just saying it seems like we were given a sort of blown off thing here, and I don't think we need to keep trying to reschedule him.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I'm... It's not like I'm desperate for Jay to be on the show.
Right, exactly.
So...
Dun, 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 dun.
Maybe, okay. if I offer him like $200. I think $200 gets it done.
Whoa.
Maybe $200, a copy of the Transformer, and a SyncBook 2. Wrap it all up, and maybe a basket of fruit, like a nice cheese, crackers, apples, pears. Kind of like the Always Record swag, you know?
Thank you for being a guest on Always Record.
So, Alan, I loved your imagery of the flux capacitor with the Tree of Life and its placement of Nedsach, Hod, Yesod, and Malkut. And then I especially liked it with the light, 777 lightning line going down the tree. And
thank you, David. I'm very proud of that. Yeah, it was after our call. I was like, oh, shit. Oh, shit.
Yeah. So that was, that was the whole idea, right? We have Doc Brown here, and we have, it's just the meaning of it. And did you catch that the medical definition of flux? So
yeah, I saw you put that up. I think that's fantastic. Yes.
An excessive discharge or flow from the body, especially the bowels. So here you have Doc Brown. And so the funny thing was, on that show, when we were talking and I was making an assessment of the Freud's ideas around anality, and what I was communicating there was actually from the book Life Against Death, which I had forgotten the name of the author, and I was like, who wrote that? Norman O. Brown. Brown, Doc Brown. That was pretty funny. But there was this whole, yeah. So you got, obviously when he's like 7.62 millimeter Full Metal Jacket. So the titular line of Full Metal Jacket, right? You have the whole thing is that I am in a world of shit. Throughout, so, and then that's repeated at the end, right before he sings Mickey Mouse. What was it? Okay, so the Mickey Mouse connection, which was kind of weird here, was that, okay, let me see here. So, Doc Brown, the character of Doc Brown is based off of two characters, one being Albert Einstein, and the other being Leopold Stokowski, which is in Fantasia with Mickey Mouse, when Mickey Mouse runs up and pulls on his curtail. And
yes.
Connection there, which I thought was really kind of interesting, especially in regard to Mickey Mouse in Fantasia, how he is the sorcerer's apprentice just the idea of that flux is like forms being repeated, forms spiraling out of control. It's the idea of something being in flux, and what exactly happens with the brooms. So the brooms, and then the way he fucking splits them with the axe, and then they just keep multiplying. Like the problem just keeps increasing, and what that communicates in terms of Crowley went into that a lot in his Magic and Theory and Practice. Just this idea of the sorcerer's apprentice and how it gets communicated. What errors in magic turn into is that things spiral out of control, and that's the idea of flux. And so when you look at Back to the Future and the Gray's Almanac and what that means, like, you have just these, this idea of what Doc Brown's greatest fear is, of bringing a physical object back through time, is what that can produce. It's like that there was a Simpsons Halloween special where Homer goes back into the time of the dinosaurs, fucks with something, and then goes back, and then the whole future has changed into the point where it's like raining donuts or something. It's that idea of making something go out of control, and that's one of the implications of the danger of time travel, that if you travel back, bring something with you, or you drop a you know, that you change the course of history completely. And so anyway, I thought that was an interesting connect of when you're dealing with magic, the pitfalls of magical workings. And so I don't know. I was going into this whole thing with that. I don't know. I thought it was interesting.
I kind of didn't want to keep revisiting this, but I mean, just because I feel like it seems like a weird fixation. But okay, you mentioned flux as being this bodily emission. You said particularly from the bowels. Well, the flux capacitor. What is a capacitor? Something that holds something. So it seems to me that the flux capacitor is the bowels in one respect, right? This is the thing that contains the flux. So in that respect, it would be the bowels. Now we have this idea of, reversing that would be perhaps putting something in there. You have this sort of idea of the OTO ninth gate, perhaps, or something like that. There was something else in what you said, but basically it seems to be that there's a really strong anal fixation in that. I mean, even the idea that you keep saying butthead, but obviously I don't see, you know, there's guys like Celtic Rebel and all that sort of stuff who they see anal and fecal correspondences in a lot of movies, and they see it as proof of some sort of anal raping cult of Hollywood movie makers, you know, whereas it's possible, again, you know, that's possible, but it does seem to me that the esoteric symbolism of that lightning strike at the top of the twin pillars being what revitalizes those lower spheres, it seems to me that it's more than just some sort of hidden joke of, hey, I like to have anal sex, or just some sort of hidden shit joke, you know, or fart joke. This is basically, the esoteric symbolism seems to be spot on enough that it's saying the concept of, here's a world of shit, here's the higher levels, and that you're trying to... What's that?
Look at it completely from a psychoanalytical perspective of the take on anatomy, and it's quite... go into, but it has to do with the nature of repression and the fact that as we're developing as infants, we're promorphously perverse, right? Or if I'm pronouncing that right, but yeah. That centered at that's where all the repression goes. And so to look at Oregon energy and Kundalini and to say, of course, that's why we repress it. It's a coiled serpent at the base of our spine that translates to the repressed anality.
Absolutely, but the whole point is to try and get it, is to release it, right? So I'm saying throughout if you look at that movie, that's basically, he has to deal with all these things, and there is the Freudian aspect. I mean, Marty literally has to try not to fuck his mother. You know, there's this Oedipal angle that's really heavy in that movie. So to think that it's not there, I guess what I'm saying is like, I see, and maybe I'm coming over to Bill's side a little bit, but I'm coming to think that these guys are a fuckload smarter than I would have given them credit. Like, I think to say, oh, it's a bunch of, you know, old guys who like anal sex and are encoding this stuff into their movie as a ha 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 anal sex or feces, it seems to sell the detail short.
Yeah, I don't even want to. I can acknowledge that possibility straight up, but I don't feel like I don't feel like that's what everything comes down to. But I think it's interesting that you have, you know, MICKYMOUSE, Mickey Mouse, Marty McFly, Matt Modine. It's all MMs, which is how you spell mem if you write out the letter mem, which is once again our hanged man character. And so I don't know. I think it's Malcolm McDowell, as Bill says here. So I it's just that's wordplay, but I find it interesting that this MM keeps on showing up for me. I can't help it.
Have you noticed at the end of the for the MICKEY MOUSA, the end of the documentary in the Shining DVD, it has Kubrick on like a wheeled camera dolly or something, and he's moving from right to left, and the big circular canisters for the film camera looks like Mickey Mouse.
Oh, I can dig that. Yeah, I've thought that before. I've looked at the cameras and seen Mickey as such. Yeah, totally. And then also, obviously, Mickey kicking Vesica Pisces on Dick's sweater when his father looks like he's about to molest him, you know? I mean, the usage of Mickey, I mean, Mickey's a classic figure. I mean, and he's all over the place. That's why it's like, it's kind of, you know, I mean, but anyways, I find it interesting just like the idea of the Mickey Mouse Club and just this notion of the club that's made for you and me and how we're, you know, it's like, that's like programming for children. Just, you know, I don't know. There's something, it feels like there's something to that.
You know, you ever like meet like a 20-year-old kid who's like, I'm going to go out to LA and write movies, or that's what I want to do with my life. And they move out there and you never hear from them again. And you just think to yourself, you know, with the complexity that we're able to get out of successful movies, even movies that have this veneer of being just trashy Hollywood entertainment, but yet they're just chock full of resonances, and sync and whatever, that there's no way that kid would be in any position to create something of that level, even by accident, it seems, right?
Okay, so see, this is an interesting area for me, because what I mean, ultimately what sync has shown me is how dumb I am and also how brilliant my subconscious is.
Okay.
You know, like, I'm a fucking moron. I accept it completely. It was a hard truth to realize, but I'm a fucking moron. But there's something that either you tap into or I don't know what. Like, I'm looking, like, this is why, of all the things I could have written about to make, you know, it was the argument I felt I needed to make in that first Sync book piece, was to say, I wrote things when I wrote things that were the worst, oh, I want to be a writer, you know, terrible, terrible scripts. And then looking back on it, going, how is all this in there? How is this in there that I didn't know about? Is that because I was programmed to put it in there by growing up on, you know, Freemasonic cartoons or whatever the fuck? Possibly. You know, was I programmed by such and such? Did I tap into something? Is this, you know, some sort of universal knowledge? This is the collective unconscious? I don't fucking know. And I'm saying is, it's hard. I'm at a point where I'm trying to figure out, is it possible? Like, I'm going to give you an example. So I went to one writing class ever, and it was something where it was really for like young starting writers, and I got invited to come to this thing, and there was this young kid there who was probably like in high school, maybe first year of college, and they said to him, this is for comic book writers, and they said, this kid goes, oh, I'm working on this story about some superhero who something something, and the teacher says to him, like, well, what's your theme, you know, what is your message, what is your whatever, and the kid's like, oh, this is just an idea I had. And the guy's like, no, you need to have a theme. You need to whatever. And I was like, and I was hearing the kid express what his character was about. And, you know, maybe I'm just psychoanalyzing the kid, but it seemed like his theme was pretty fucking clear. It was like, you know, a young minority kid who wanted to see a minority superhero, wanted to see someone of color empowered and all this sort of stuff. The themes were fucking there. He didn't have to, like, spell it out. He didn't have to, you know, paint a fucking picture of, hey, this is my whole backstory and this is what I want. And he wasn't even consciously doing it. He just, this is what he wanted to see. And it was expressed it through, it was being expressed through it. Now, I think back to that one class a lot now, because I think all this stuff, you can be a Terry Gilliam and stick all your esoteric knowledge into a movie like Dr. Parnassus. You can be a Guy Ritchie and put all your Kabbalistic knowledge into a movie like Revolver. Or you can be a total fucking schmuck who just wants to tell a story and stumbles upon the mysteries of the universe. I don't know.
Yeah. So I keep coming back to the idea that the fool and the magician are the same character, right? As well as the high priestess, but that's another thing to go into. But just the fact that the awareness test that I was bringing up, that it's a juggler, right? So the bear is hidden behind the juggler, and people, if they're paying attention to the juggler, miss the bear. I couldn't help but think that that's like why the magician was originally represented as this juggler, right? And how appropriate comes in light of the fact that any good magician is has something else going on that you're paying attention to that is the thing that makes you miss what's happening behind the scene. So that's the nature of sleight of hand, is to put a forefront. Now, to say that the magician is also the fool kind of suggests that we ourselves are the magician juggling, right? We ourselves are also missing our own bear, so to speak. So whatever it is that's moonwalking behind the scene that we're not catching is our own expression. It's just on another level. So when you say that you feel that your subconscious is infinitely smarter than you, that seems like the juggler or the magician and the fool seem to be like those two aspects of your mind, right? Mm-hmm. So that magician is the one who feels like he's being the trickster, right? But you could also say that the magician is a fool to his own trick. Like, he doesn't even realize the trick that's actually being accomplished in his act, because he's focused on how it's like the nature of ego is that because there's pride inherent in any ego, that pride or that like stance of like, this is what I'm doing and this is what I'm about, is the very thing that's veiling his own intentions or what he's actually accomplishing. And that could be said for the great work in general, that whatever our contribution is, isn't even in our own scope.
Yeah, I thought that myself, what you just said, is that you don't really have to worry about getting credit for anything you discover because the universe kind of knows. If you get to something first and you put it out there, you can be pissed you didn't get monetary gain off of that. And you shouldn't, you can recognize that. You shouldn't let it consume you, because if you really did get to something first, the universe knows where novelty is born. So,
right. And to accomplish the quote unquote great work is beyond our limited grasp and perspective anyway. It's like a Cloud Atlas with the girl who is the sacrifice, right? So the slave girl who basically sees behind the veil and knows the Soylent Green reality. Although she knows that this limited act won't bring an end to anything out of itself, you do it anyway because it's moving towards this aim. And so no matter how limited your part may be, you recognize the bigger picture to whatever extent you're capable of and do your role anyway, right?
Exactly.
I hope I didn't just ruin Cloud Atlas for anybody.
Spoiler alert. You know what's awesome about that movie is that when you see it a second time, knowing what you know, the whole movie takes such a completely dark turn when you first see them eating that substance. That
right.
Just isn't in there, not knowing the reveal. And I love how that movie is malleable in that moment. It makes it a better movie.
Right.
And
so that reminds me of Joe Alexander's thing of when one person sees another person accomplish some feat, everything becomes possible. So if you see something in a new lens, that's the standard from that point forward, right?
Exactly.
Does that, yeah. I mean, So I've been having this phenomenon happen with my art where I realize, you know those mind's eye pictures where you stare at it and then eventually it pops out. And then every time you look at it after that, you see, no matter how long it took you to begin with, you've just gotten used to being able to relax your eyes and see the pop-out image. If you relax your eyes looking at these collages that I've been doing, it does the same thing. Because of the way that it's cut in layers, it becomes three-dimensional. And so I realized this after, I mean, how long was I staring at it while I'm putting them together for the longest time? I never caught that that's, you can do that with them. And if you do the same thing you do with those mind's eye pictures, it becomes three-dimensional. But now they're hanging up in my place, and every time I look at them, immediately they're popping out. And as long as it took me to see that, I never saw that. But then once I've seen it, I can't stop seeing it. And so I think that there's something to be said for that. Even like in a Kubrick film, like you may have seen it 50 fucking times, but then you spot the fucking bear bug show up and then disappear. And then every time you see it, you can't help but recognize that. And in a way, you're juggling in terms of action, you know. I don't know. There's something to be said for the way we perceive the bits and pieces of information, like that, to a juggling act. You know.
No, I love it. I do love it. I just have to wonder again, like. And maybe it's just because I'm not as smart as Stanley Kubrick, you know, but can someone see the three-dimensional image while they're putting the thing together and still put it together in such a way that's so exact that you can make it pop for someone else 30 years later? You know, can you control to that level? And obviously I know he put a tremendous amount of detail into it. I'm just saying, I don't know. It's just going to be a question that I don't know if it's possible that someone could ever outsmart synchronicity. Like, as brilliant as you could be, there's still going to be things in there that you didn't plan or that you at least weren't completely conscious of.
You know, it always comes back to chess for me, because when the game was created, when they finally got the pieces together that would make up what we have today, like the board sits in front of us today as it did when they finally got it together and the rules were there, there's no way they could have known the complexity and to the level that they would, that game could be played, correct?
Right.
And all the esoteric connections between chess and how it has the 64 squares of the I Ching, which mirrors DNA, is that there's some sort of harmonic level where things that manifest to a seemingly infinite degree seem to come to rest on a certain plane, you know? So I think that Stanley Kubrick understood film and understood the boundaries of a 64 squared grid and approached it that way and knew that if he threw all of the right ingredients into that square, it would begin to manifest over the years. So I think it's about architecture. If you know the architecture, then you can build something that moves through time.
Right. It's not that he knew everything that was going to come out of it, but you know how to create. It's sort of like creating a space in which it can manifest.
Yes, and so that's what makes it dangerous,
I think. That I can agree with. That idea I can get behind. What I thought your position was that he knew, you know, every move on that chessboard 30 years out, and I'm thinking, I don't think that any human mind could comprehend all the different individual interpretations that everyone with their particular set and setting were going to bring to his movies, and how those perspectives might be in some way as accurate or revealing of something that he might have been unconscious of or whatever. You know, that's what the point I was trying to make. But if you're saying you think he was smart enough to understand how to put enough of his own shit in there, a few red herrings, and weave space for all the other interpretations and so on, so on, so on, that I can definitely get behind.
He knew the foundation on which to build the structure that you could keep going into. So whenever you're dealing with an archetype, you're dealing with a node in a sense, right? It's where the lines converge. So he would take those that convergence and just like present it in such an uncanny way that you can just go on and on and on with it. But yeah, I couldn't agree more with the 64 hexagrams being communicated throughout the piece. And I don't think he's the only one to approach in that way. I think that there's a number of them, and I would definitely include Darren Aronofsky in that regard and Lars von Trier in the way that they use the same formula that Kubrick did. To the extent that you're going to be able to just keep going into those forever.
That's why I think that a director like P.T. Anderson with The Master, he took a bit of a gamble because he knew that that film would not reach its full potential for many, many years. That it will be upon viewings 5, 6, 7, 10 years from now that people will look back and really appreciate exactly what it was he had created. Because that movie needs to move through time now. It needs to start to soak up what it was built to soak up.
When people talk about 2001 from the perspective of how far off it is from the year 2001, like understanding that this isn't like a prediction of what the future is going to be like, that is like so far removed from what the whole purpose of the thing is. And also it's interesting that so many critics hated 2001 when it first came out. It was like despised, like they were like offended that they sat through something, including like there's a I remember seeing Siskel and Ebert do their top 20 films of all time or something like that, and 2001 A Space Odyssey was number one on their list, and they gave it 2 thumbs down when it first came out, and they made a public statement that was their biggest mistake in all of their movie reviews was their assessment of 2001. I like that a lot.
Like that. Yeah, no, that's...
They brought the two towers down.
Siskel and Ebert were actually the two towers, and when they put 2001 A Space Odyssey 2 thumbs down, they inadvertently brought down the towers, which they identified with.
But there's something to be said about something like chess, in that, you know, the kind of supercomputer that can compete with a grandmaster in chess wasn't around in Kubrick's day. You know, they hadn't built a machine that could calculate the amount of options and what was the best option in 1968. So you flash forward, you know, 30 years where I think it's Karpovsky is playing Big Blue. I probably got that wrong. But ultimately, the human being can still defeat the world's greatest supercomputer when it comes to chess. Now, human beings cannot beat a supercomputer when it comes to Jeopardy, where it's answering questions, a question and answer. So in that game, the supercomputer will triumph over the smartest human being. But with chess, the human being triumphs over the computer. And it's understanding exactly why that is I think, the key to it all.
Right. Do you know that... as far as I know, at least this was true until relatively recently, that there is no computer that was able to do the same thing that we've been able to do with chess as able to do with Go.
So that perfect, yeah.
So they haven't been able to do that yet. Which you'd think would be actually less complex, but it's far more complex to predict outcomes with Go. Which is why there's, you know, Go Masters are a whole other level. And so, and then Go, once again, is a reflection of the 64 hexagrams, at least in terms of dynamics. So your Go and I Ching are like are two sides of it. Go is the expression of the I Ching playing out, at least on some archetypal level. And so that becomes really noteworthy in terms of what we're talking about. I find it interesting that the Guy Ritchie film Revolver centers around the game chess, where he says the only way you become smarter is by playing a smarter opponent. If you've seen Revolver, which is one of my favorites, it's interesting to consider that a revolver, a handgun, is basically Metatron's cube, as the six circles surrounding the seventh point, which is their access point, right? And so to look at the fact that you're saying you have 64 squares, you have 64 hexagons that make up the I Ching, here you have a connection that's being made between a hexagon and chess with revolver. And then, of course, the whole film is Kabbalistic in essence. Kabbalah is the tree itself is the six directions being repeated on different levels, right? So that's interesting, to say the least.
Yeah. I think that it's essential that you understand in a chessboard that there are 64 squares. I think it's very important to understand why they're squares. And that the whole notion of the squaring the circle, right? I think a lot of people... I think I'm there with that concept. It took me a long time. And I think people get it wrong at times.
What is your interpretation? Because I have a sort of cipher that I've come to with that, but I'm curious what yours is.
I think that one has to transcend one's ego is to kind of understand that in the human form, we're essentially out of place. We are the square inside the circle, that we are not a perfect fit with our environment. But it is that space between the rigid borders of the square and the circle that surrounds, that's where our humanness exists. So when a computer plays chess, it might be a perfect square within a square. It has every single move possible in front of it. Because a computer works on that level, it doesn't have the space of doubt. It doesn't have that missing area.
It's Graham. Sorry. I'm talking about the squaring of the circle.
Okay.
In a Herschel hexagram, it's not obeying the same laws that you would expect. Masons use it for building significant things. The best explanation I've seen of squaring the circle is actually in a Drumvelel Melchizedek book, his first book, The Ancient Secret of the Flower of Life, where I don't know if I'm going to read this, but I don't know how well it'll translate without the diagram. But basically, all the diagram is a circle with a square in it, and the universal hexagram. The Thelemic hexagram, basically,
yeah.
Or it's the square,
yeah. Yeah,
within the thing. So he says, here's someone at the door. I standing there. I had never seen him before in my life. He knocked. Okay, hold on. I'm going to skip it. He says, okay. So, he said, I was sent here by the Masons to tell you about the circle and the square. This really did me. I sort of froze my tracks. Let me see. Anything you have to tell me, I want to know what it is. So he drew this figure, and then he shows the figure. First he drew the square, then he drew a circle around the square in a particular way, and there was this image I had seen glowing in the room. I thought, this is going to be good. He divided the square into four sections, then he drew diagonals from the corners through the middle to the opposite corners. Then he drew diagonals through the four smaller squares. Then he drew lines from, it says, I to E and E to J, which you can't see without the diagram. But next he drew lines from I to H and H to J. And so basically he goes, up to this point, I had no problem. But then he drew a line from A to nowhere, G, which I'm looking at. And it's showing how when you draw a line from the corner, not to the center, but slightly above the center, and it says, and back to B, and from D to nowhere, and F back to C. I said, wait a minute, that isn't in the rules I was given. That doesn't fit. There's nothing there. And he said, it's okay, because this line, A to G, is parallel with that line, I to H. And this line, D to F, is parallel to this line, J to E. And, I said, that's a new rule. I didn't have that one before. I mean, there's nothing there. Parallel lines, oh, okay, I'll listen. Then he began to tell all kinds of things. He said, first, there is a key that the circumference of the circle and the perimeter of the square are equal, which is what I told you before. This circle and square is the same image seen from the air as from the Great Pyramid with a ship on top, which is his own trip out. But anyways, it's still, there's something to it that that what he's describing is, if you were looking down at the Great Pyramid, it's one interpretation of it, because here you have this square, which is the Great Pyramid, right? But there's these lines. So if you're building a structure, people have a very limited scope of how to approach a figure. You want a perfect vector metric, which is what the hexagram is, right? Every line in the figure, even if you were to draw the circumference, would be the same length. So that every, you know, that you have a compensation from all sides that allows for a perfect equilibrium to exist. But what's interesting about the squaring of the circle is that it has the same thing. It has that equilibrium, but it goes against all simple logic of how to produce that. And so you can build on top of this thing in a way that doesn't feel right, just from a limited point of view, because the lines are dealing with parallels that make it compensated, but not in a way you'd expect, if that makes any sense, which can translate in all kinds of ways.
Oh, yeah. Guys, I'm going to have to get running. I have another job interview.
Go, Alan Green.
I'm going to drop something on you real quick. For whatever it's worth, this is my little, you know the story of Hiram Abiff, right?
Yeah.
But the Bible refers to Hiram, son of Tyre, that first name has a historical precedence. Where does Abiff come from? Well, to
the
best
of
my
future.
Oh, I didn't even think of that. Biff, okay, then maybe you guys will be able to dissect that some, because basically what I realized is that squaring the circle, right? So Hiram Abiff is the sort of, you know, the master mason, and he, what a mason's, masons of course, go up in degrees, right? So the man and the degrees, that the man can go up in degrees. Well, a circle, of course, also has degrees, 360 of them. So to square the circle, the 360 squared, 360 times 360 is 129,600. Okay? So you get this number, 129,600. We'll just do straight up alphanumeric replacement. 1 is A, 2 is B, 9 is I, 6 is F. The name of Biff encodes the squared circle.
Wow.
That's far out.
So, but there is a Biff in Back to the Future, and I'm going to have to think about that. Guys, have a great day. I'll talk to you soon, all right?
Good luck, Alan.
Thanks, man. So yeah, I've been scrolling through the images trying to find a example of the actual. Oh, here we go. This is what I'm looking for. Found it. Okay, here. Just give me 1 second. I'll send it to you. It's so funny that sometimes it can be. So okay, I still need to go back. That'd be so challenging sometimes to just find.
Yeah, right.
Simple image, because it's pretty. Shouldn't be as obscure as it is. So here, this is what he's describing.
Okay, wow, up there it's the unicursal hexagram, right? Then blue.
Yeah, right. And so that's, I mean, in essence, yeah. And so,
but there is no square inside the circle that touches all four points to the circle.
What do you mean?
I don't know. Like, there's no, you have
right,
a certain, right.
Yeah, it's not actually fitting in that way. So you can see in the center of it, there's this, there's a perfect square.
Mm-hmm.
See the quadrants that are actually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 quadrants to this square. And then there's obviously the much larger square.
Mm-hmm.
But I love how there's just like, they use this, like, this is like a, you know, what would you call it? Like, it's like the cornerstone of their building. Yet at the same time, it doesn't follow any straightforward rules like one would want.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But it works, it's functional. And so that's really, it's really strange how they did that.
Yeah, I'm going to have to spend some time with that. I mean, I know Melchizedek and the Seed of Life that they do, which is a manipulation of the circles with the Vesica Pisces and then extending upon that and showing sort of like a geometric matrix of seeds of life, and that this is the universe, you know, like that's their kind of deal, right?
Right. I don't think, like, you know, I mean, the ancient secret of the flower of life is really not that hugely recommended, as far as I'm concerned. There's gems in it, but his ego is just so, it's intense to read, and then things will get an authority because he's channeled them from Thoth. And is laying them out in such and such a way, and it's like, okay, well, you know, he doesn't have to say where anything came from other than he was told by a deity.
Oh, yeah, it's real, it's convenient. I need to get one of those.
A deity to, yeah, I'm like, well, I got this from...
a point of reference for anything I really want to take to the next level, just...
Yeah, so I don't know. I want to like apply this in all kinds of ways, because I don't know. I don't know if I ever showed you. There's a short YouTube video. I think I must have shown it to you quite a while back, of the Babylonian Sun Square.
Yeah, and I've watched that a couple of times. Absolutely. That your introduction. For some reason, the way you explain that with that video and understanding what magic squares are and how it all works, that was huge in condensing a whole shitload of information. Like, absolutely one of the most essential conceptual things that I was able to grasp over the last 12 months. Absolutely huge.
Cool. Yeah, and what's funny is that you don't fucking see that anywhere. Like, I mean, there's that presentation, which is very brief, and yet I've never come across somebody like just pointing that out, that you can take the Babylonian Sun Square, fold it into a cylinder, and here you have diagonal steps going in like basically an infinite spiral, and so you can see how it is like. I mean, this is an extrapolation, not an absolute statement, but there seems to be a correlation between this and the meaning of the Tower of Babel. Because, of course, it says, you know, the way that they translated it in English is that they wanted Babylon wanted to make a name for itself. But the usage of the term name that's used here, people say, is make fame for themselves, to become well-known or established in that way. Yeah, this is a very close verse, not very long after this. You have the introduction of what Kabbalists take as a reference to Tetragrammaton. It seems to suggest that the name that the Tower of Babel is built on top of, meaning like the foundation of that they used to apply to the building of the tower, is itself Tetragrammaton. You know, or at least their understanding of the name. You know, it's a significant thing to say the name for themselves.
Keep going, but I got to bring this to something.
Yeah.
I've just been thinking about the British invasion lately. Okay, and so, and what do we understand the British invasion to be? We immediately think of rock and roll, which is funny, because if you think of, in all seriousness, British invasion for an American should make you think of the American Revolutionary War. Whatever. So, but what we just naturally associate it with something kind of colorful and fun. But maybe, like, the whole idea of the United States as being the esoteric construction of a massive magic square.
Right.
And that the first true test of whether or not it worked was the British invasion, which was to take a new art form that was perfected overseas, and then to pump it into this magic square and to see how many different manifestations of that sound it could generate. And so what you have is during the 60s and 70s, you know, because it wasn't one country, it wasn't America, because you had different sections of the magic square, each section went to work and developed its own version of that British invasion. So instead of just having the American response to the British invasion, you ended up having the East Coast, the Midwest, the West Coast, and the South. But then within each quadrant, you had each individual state's response to the British invasion. So much so in that you would actually have bands that were just named Chicago, Boston.
Right?
So it was like we have our cauldron or our magic square, which is America, and then we have our capital, which is England. And whenever we get something perfected in England, you just send it over into the magic square and it will multiply. And then we can select the most potent and the strongest versions that multiply in our 50-sectioned magic square.
Yeah.
Now, is that by design? Kind of. I think you could argue that that was the whole point.
Yes.
But did they understand the extent to which that design worked? Probably not.
It's just like what you're saying about a Kubrick film. They laid out the foundation, and then everything set up within the parameters of the thing. It's like the Gregorian calendar. You have something that's universally applied and everybody takes part in, and then it can't help but fall into these, you know, kind of like laid out parameters.
Absolutely.
That is how I also take the idea of the law of the age, right? Where you have that there's the law, like the law that was laid out in, what is it, Ecclesiastes or whatever.
Okay.
And then you have, well, Moses brings the law, right? I mean, that's the whole thing. He steps down off Sinai and he's holding the law of the age. And then you have, you know, 2,000 years later or whatever, you have the New Testament is taken to be the law of the new age. Now, what Crowley was hit to was like, let's make the channel a new law. But the law isn't just simply rules. The law is the parameters that are foundational, that are laid down, that people have to kind of like, that they, you know, you can't ultimately escape from, unless if you, it's like a kind of like the Tibetan idea of the deity that we're all part of, that you can't quite get out of, who they usually have it like represented as like a malevolent giant force. Like you look at the imagery and it doesn't look that that happy, you know. It's like, like, and that's the realm of duality, right? But just that idea of laying the foundation and then knowing that whatever transpires is happening within this field, and that to escape from the field is quite a feat, right? Because it's everywhere and
exactly,
it's everything.
Exactly. And I think that what we're experiencing right now with America is that because it's such a laboratory, because it is a, it's where North meets South meets East meets West, you know, it is the sort of designated, you know, like the whole idea that, you know, Switzerland was a neutral country, so no one fucked with it in World War II. You know, they're not into this shit. So the war just happened around them. I mean, it's just such a, absolutely ridiculous notion.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, yeah, they said they didn't want to play. Leave them alone. No, it was a fucking, it was a haven. It was like a timeout if you needed just whatever. Take it however you want to take it. But just the idea is absurd. Just any rules of war is just absurd. But that, you know, as America has decayed, the rest of the world, I think, has gotten better. You know, it's like America is the picture of Dorian Gray.
Mm-hmm.
That it's been designed to make mistakes and to absorb shit so that the entire sphere that it's in the middle of will gradually get better. The only question is, will the rest of the world get better, stronger, fast enough to save America? Or will America be worth saving?
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're posing some pretty big questions. It's funny, I couldn't help but think of Sherlock Holmes' assistant, Watson, how in the Game of Shadows, he's like, at the beginning, he's like, let's leave him out of this because he's getting married. You know, he's done.
Yeah, yeah.
Leave him out of it. You know, it's like, and then right before the guy, before Watson takes the tower down, the shooter guy who's up there, the marksman or sniper or whatever, he goes, that's not fair, when he sees a giant cannon face at him. It's like the rules of war. It's like, oh, what the fuck? Like, how, you know? And so I also found it really interesting in that that video of the Babylonian Sun Square, how was it? Oh, I'm losing it. Yeah, I'm drawing a blank, and not necessarily the best thing I ever drew.
In the video, he's discussing the Babylonian Sun Square, and he goes through the different levels. How doesn't it circle around? Or
I don't know where I was going with that. I lost it. It's okay. What are you going to do?
What are you going to do?
Fuck. Huh. Oh, right. So there was an obelisk type tower that's at the center of his map. When he's applying the Sun Square to the selling of the corporation, he shows the map, and at the center of the square, because he's laying one square within another square, you have these planetary squares. So the sun, obviously 666 being 111 for every row, duplicated. Then he lays, I forget what it is. It might be the Saturn square or something. But then at the top of it all, he has the Mars square, which is 5x5. And in the center of that, when he applies it to the map, you have this giant fucking obelisk that they take now as a Civil War memorial, even though it was built long before the Civil War, you know, and at the head of it is Mars. You have this giant fucking obelisk with Mars at the top, the god Mars, and then it's taken. It's like, what is this thing about? And so it's like, you know, obviously you have here, you have your Iron Man in the center of the Matrix, you know. So it all comes down to this, basically. I mean, that's at the head of it, which is you know, kind of a heavy intention to set. Yet it's the best of our ability to relate these squares to the map. Like when we try to express it, this is how it gets expressed. So what are you going to do but do it? As far as they were concerned, you know, it's like, this is how it works.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, so, okay, to, you know, with the whole Kubrick thing was that, you know, room 237, I was connecting to the 237 years that the American experiment was going to be afforded. So it starts in 1776, and they're going to give it 237 years, and in 2013, they'll see just how well that experiment worked, and they'll know what it is to do with America in that year. And so here we are. Kubrick fascination seems to be probably at an all-time global awareness. You know, conspiracy-minded elements seem to be fairly mainstream, or at least it's understood. You know, I don't know. People want something to happen, right? They want something big to occur that unites us all, but maybe that where those things won't happen anymore. I don't know. It's going to be amazing to see the first major incident of 2013 to see what it is and how people approach it.
Sure.
Or if it will even happen in America. Maybe something so big and something we can't even predict will happen so large that will happen on another side of the world that finally America will not be the focus. Maybe people in America will kind of like not be so concerned about America. Maybe that's just our issue. That's our problem. I don't know.
Do you have your camera working? Can you see me?
Yeah, I can.
Okay, I don't see you, but that's fine. There's this book. Have you ever seen this before? The Secret Destiny of America by Manly P. Hall.
Wow, no, I haven't. Jesus, I didn't even know that existed.
You'd love this. So what you're talking about, this is like kind of, you know, the relatively authoritative statement on America as an experiment. This book gives like actual evidence for how Christopher Columbus knew fucking damn well what he was doing. This wasn't like a mistake. And there's the proof of that is that I think it's his cousin or something. It has the information in here somewhere of how there was actually a map that predates Columbus being here. And they found it in the belongings of his cousin, actually. And so there's Columbus's ties to the royalty, actually, but there's like abounding evidence that he was sent here by the royal family in order to establish you know, this grand experiment. And so this goes into Francis Bacon and all this awesome stuff, and just this the utopian idea and how America was meant to be this utopia. But basically, it gives evidence that we're simply a colony of England, and that what you can extrapolate from this is that all the fighting that went on was not, you know, the leaders were hip to what was taking place, but that people were allowed to die for a cause that just didn't exist as they knew it. You know, out of chaos comes order, basically. And so, you know.
What year was that book written?
Let me check. Originally copyright 1944.
Really? That's crazy.
Yeah, have the origin of the democratic ideal, the world's first democrat, westward ocean travel to earthly paradise, you know, the first election of lawmakers, and so a new identity for Christopher Columbus, like obviously. Okay, so here he has the synopsis. He says, many scholars were fully aware of the global form of the earth in the time of Columbus, who, according to early historians, state documents, and his own son, was not an Italian of humble station and uneducated, but was a Greek prince with an excellent classical education. It was from a Greek port that he sailed on the celebrated voyage of discovery. He was accompanied by a mysterious stranger, which has suggested that Columbus was an agent of the Society of Unknown Philosophers. The pattern of the democratic ideal was beginning to assert itself over the tyranny of decadent aristocracy. A new world was necessary for a new idea. When it was necessary, it was discovered.
Because it's the whole idea of, you know, if you've got stomach cancer, you just can't take out the stomach and expect the body to live. You need a new stomach.
There was indisputable evidence that the Templars were here long before Columbus was here. Not that long before it, but long enough for it to be noteworthy. And so the fact that scouts were here looking and left their mark in a few places makes it enough evidence to be like, well, what the fuck? And so his name is obviously symbolic of the dove. He's Noah's dove that's sent out from the ark in order to, like, There's no mistake there.
That is what was considered proper magical preparation for big events, you know? We assign names and designs to them because we think of it as marketing. Because you want to sell t-shirts, you want to be able to talk about it in the news, you want to give it substance so people can know about what something is. But to assign specific names or to make a flag, that was inherent in their magical system. It was like an externalized prayer to attract blessings from the stars or whatever, correct?
Yeah, God oversees, you know, what we're building and approves, basically.
Exactly. And to just to appreciate, yeah, that's the thing. Like, I think Crowley is probably how most people get an understanding of the alternative term magic, you know. And I can't judge him for how people misinterpret it or for people who have interpretations that I don't necessarily agree with. I can't blame him for it, you know. But I think it's a concept and a term that is seemingly near mainstream now, but it's so radically fragmented. There's a million different interpretations of it. There's a million different understandings of it. It's a lot like love. You know, people use that word, but how many different kinds and how many different shades? It's just the word just doesn't seem to do justice to what it's attempting to communicate or attempting to label. And I think that's just a virtue of people being sold pop magic or corporate magic or a generic type of magic. Vinnie Eastwood just contacted me. I told him about how he tried to get Jay Widener, but he was nowhere to be found. And he said, it took me quite a while to lock him down. Needed three reminders leading up to the interview. So there you go.
Okay.
I just got to hit him like a bunch more times, like every other day.
I have not contacted again Jay Widener's producer, Mitch Santel, who I basically, you know, requested that he join our show. I wanted to talk to you about my friend Alex, who will be, he plans to do the show from Peru. Mm-hmm. With, you know, there could be a degree of technical difficulties because he said at that particular time he's not, he's in a place where, you know, it could be touchy, but at the same time, he gives like an 85% chance that it'll be fine.
Okay.
But I like the novelty of talking to him while he's in Peru. I think it's a risk worth taking personally, but I wanted to let you know that it's slightly more of a risk than I understood because I mean, whenever he has his Facebook things of Alex at home and Alex abroad. And, he uses the internet regularly when he's traveling and it's not usually a problem, but who knows?
Did you see that in April we're going to have Znor from Group Name for Grape Juice?
Yeah, which means we're going to have a midnight show, right?
Yeah, is that going to be okay for you?
Oh, yeah, that should be fine.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. I just want to make sure.
Thursday?
It'll be a Thursday, and it'll be 10 p.m. your time.
Yeah, that should be fine.
Awesome.
That sounds like fun. I like the novelty of talking to people from other various regions. It's kind of cool.
Absolutely. So. I think we'll get our South American checklist and we'll get our Japanese. He's in Japan. He's not Japanese, but yeah, definitely. I don't know. Maybe it's worthwhile to hammer Jay one more time to get him back on the show. I don't know. I don't want to have to work. That sounds lazy. I don't know. We'll see.
Well,
put it this way. I'll be more inclined to make it work if he gets back to me and sort of can appreciate being disappointed, you know?
Yeah. All right.
Sorry about that.
Was that a phone?
It was, I'm at the bar, and so there's speakers in this room, and when the main system turns on, it started pumping out some jams, so I just had to turn that volume down.
All right. Maybe this conversation is drawing to a close here. Is that?
I think so.
Okay.
Can you see this? See the bear that I drew right here?
Keep it up. Where? Oh, down there. Yeah, yeah. I see it.
If you look at the Shining poster and look for that bear, you'll see it.
Yeah. No, I know what you're saying. It's not as you know, like when you do the mind's eye and you see the thing and you're like, oh my God, that's totally there. It's more like kind of obscure. But I can see what you're talking about.
Well, that's what I love about it, because I think that that guy, whoever Sean Fella is he wants you to see the stuff that pops out that's undeniable, but he also pushes you to see stuff that's in that fuzzy zone, which is a perfect thing to get people to see in a movie like The Shining, because you know, if you do believe in ghosts or spirits and stuff like that, and people say they've seen them, I mean, you talk about the most fuzzy kind of thing. You can't. No one's ever documented a ghost and had the worldwide public say, that's a ghost. That's definitely a ghost. You know, it can never get to that black and white objective place. Same with aliens. You know, for as many people you talk to, and you can kind of say, you know, I can kind of agree with that. No one has come forward with the rock-solid, smoking-gun alien evidence. Now, some people might say, you know, the pyramids, or they might point to something like that, and that can be its own conversation. But, you know, when you talk about the existence of aliens or UFOs, can you go right to, like, one specific piece of film or photograph to say, yep, that's that? I mean, it's...
Yeah. The government built saucer that's completely disclosed at this point that you can see. I mean, it's a saucer. It flies, you know.
Yeah.
From the U.S., you know, that's something, but it's not necessarily proof of aliens. It's just proof that there's flying saucers.
You know, that would be something to talk to that Sean guy for the show.
This book, The Secret Destiny of America, I was trying to find the part where he talks about it, but I'm pretty damn sure that this is the one where he lays out a few of the examples of how the continents or the sections of the world were associated with the different signs by the ancients. And so you can see examples of this occurring in our current symbolism. Of like, I think it's Mexico's Draco or something, and why they have the snake is their South America, it's a snake, and then how we're the Phoenix, we're Scorpio, and so we become associated with obviously the eagle, but the eagle is the Phoenix, and you know, the Scorpio Phoenix, but then that Russia is the bear. And why they're associated with the bear is because of the bear constellation. And so he goes into communicating that. But I thought that was interesting as we were talking. I couldn't help but when we were making, Alan pointed out the association of Mars and iron that we call during the Cold War the Iron Curtain of Russia that we can't see past. It's just that's kind of a appropriate usage of iron in that respect. Just consider obviously Dr. Strangelove, and which we've done before in relationship to the bear. And then of course, there's the admitted, meaning of Dr. Strangelove where they're going back and forth that it's all sexual frustration and us dropping the bomb is us getting with the mother. And so you can take it both, you know, you can take it on that level. You can also take it on the Freudian level that it's Mother Russia. And it's a mother bear, and what that means for Wendy to walk into the room and see the bear going down on the man, that it's like the mother going down on the man. It's Mother Russia going down on America.
I like that a lot. You know,
we have a relationship in that way, and that it's all sexual frustration is what our commanders in chiefs are experiencing and how it translates is their own subconscious sexual frustrations taking it out through war, and that's the real Iron Curtain.
I like that a lot. That's
yeah.
And someone had made a very good description of 2001. The opening scene is the Cold War across the pond, the monkeys.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, totally. You could translate that over into the frustration of King Kong with our Jessica Lange and Naomi Watts, right?
Hey, have you seen Fear and Desire by Kubrick?
Yeah, I did at one point a long time ago, yeah.
I've got to see that. I just learned that the main character is a black soldier.
What?
Is a black, an African-American soldier.
Okay, I'm trying to remember. So Fear and Desire is not the boxing one?
No, it's this movie where these soldiers find themselves in a war that they don't know what they're fighting for. It seems like a big Twilight Zone episode. He brings up the Tempest in a speech about Prospero, but the main character is a black soldier named Mac. And so I read as, his name is Mac, I think Macintosh, the Apple computer. The fact that he's black reminds me of the monolith and how an iPhone, when it came out, was all black. And that he's a soldier, I think the soldier and the hunchback. So the soldier is the exclamation point. And if you notice, with I, a lot of people since the 60s have, for some reason, they always put the I lowercase. So it's just an upside down exclamation point. So sure. Like if you look at the album Smile, the I is just a lowercase I. The iPhone, it's a lowercase I. In Understanding Media by McLuhan, he uses a lowercase I. So it's an upside-down soldier. It's you talk about a hanged man. You know, soldier fights for his country, but then when he finds out the truth, you know, that kind of revolutionary process of coming to terms with exactly what you were fighting for. I don't know. I got to see that fucking movie, but just seemed pretty interesting.
Killer's Kiss, which I saw, but I'm sure I've seen this one too. I have them all in my computer, actually, including this one. I don't know how I could send that to you, but you can find yourself a copy of it pretty easily.
Yeah, I'm going to get a copy.
So yeah, so when he escapes, he fatally shoots her while shouting about William Shakespeare's The Tempest, which is interesting because, I mean, The Tempest is being able to start storms and sink ships. So you could take it that it's sink, right? I mean, that's what The Tempest is centered around. It's the sinking of ships, you know?
And people have connected the character of Prospero to John Dee.
Oh, really?
Absolutely.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I love how when the first film came out of The Tempest, they have the symbol of Mercury smack dab in the center of all the posters for it, which is interesting because isn't the character that shows up in The Tempest supposed to be Mercury? Say that outright?
No, I think so.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
He's all in the spiel. Yeah, that was one of my favorite Shakespeare plays. I never saw it live. I never saw it done, you know. But I started to watch the new film, which I really was liking, but Amy couldn't follow it and wasn't into it, and he gets over, and I was like, okay, whatever. But yeah, I've been meaning to check that out again. Yeah, there was a few things that I can't remember what they all were, but yeah, that was definitely.